We are reading through the Bible this year, specifically focusing on the New Testament. There are two tracks which you can jump right into and join in. As Justin, the guy who did the announcements, who leads our immersion service, said at least one of the services this weekend, he said, it's not like watching episodes of Lost, where if you miss one, you know, you can never make up. But reading through the Bible is something you can pick up in at any time, and I want to encourage you to do that. We are up to the book of Romans now, which is the deepest theological work in the whole Bible. It describes our relationship with God. It describes what it takes to get right in God's sight. Starting in chapter 1, verse 16, Paul writes in this letter to the Romans, and remember, Paul's the one who went through this huge transformation himself. He was a great detail guy, legalistic warrior of God's law, and he had great distaste for Christians. He had this huge transformation, and he started to see the truth of God in a whole different way. He writes in verse 16, I'm not ashamed of this good news, the good news about Jesus Christ. It is the power of God at work, saving everyone who believes, the Jew first, but also the Gentile. Not just those of us who are descendants of Abraham, Paul is saying, but everybody. The Gentiles include everybody else on the face of the earth. It is the power of God, this good news about Jesus Christ, saving everyone who believes. This good news, verse 17, tells us how God makes us right in his sight. How do we know that we're going to stand righteous before a holy God someday in judgment? Where do we have any kind of assurance of our salvation? How do we know that we know that we are right in God's sight? It's only by faith. It is through faith, the end of verse 17 says, that a righteous person has life. So Paul doesn't hold anything back. He basically sets up his whole letter to the Romans in this introductory statement, the first 17 verses of chapter 1, by saying, the only way we're going to get right with God, that we're going to be right in his sight, is by faith, which comes to us by God's grace. Grace is undeserved gifts, merit, undeserved favor of God. It's getting what we don't deserve, and it's not getting what we do deserve. Grace is the only way we're getting in. In fact, to make sure that you personalize this, turn to the person next to you and say, the only way you're getting right with God is grace, baby. That's it. That's your only chance. You don't have to say all that, but put it in your own words. It's only by grace. Now, that's offensive. Well, grace is offensive. Grace is offensive to a lot of people who think they're good enough, who think that they're righteous enough just by the way they live, just by the way they go about keeping moral boundaries, just by the way they kind of wander through this world. And they say, it doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter who you trust. It doesn't matter. These relationships with God are not the thing. It's not what God does. It's what we do. It's all on us. It's like a pass-fail class that you can take. You either pass or you fail. And if you're good enough, you'll pass. And if you're not good enough, you're going to fail. You'll be able to stand right before God if you're a decent person, and if you're not a decent person, you won't be able to stand right before God. Whether you believe in God, whether you know about God, is irrelevant, they say, a lot of these folks. Paul addresses that next kind of thought out of his mouth as we go through chapter 1. He says, ever since the world was created, verse 20, ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. Even if nobody's ever told you about God, Paul is saying, you have no excuse. You should be able to know that there is a God because you look around the creation that God has made, the nature that's around us that God has his hand in. You know, beautiful art doesn't just create itself. This painting behind me underneath the screens, the greens and yellows, the fire of God's spirit represented there, which was painted by Michael Brangocio, who's a big part of this church and an extremely well-accomplished artist. He did that whole mural. It's just an amazing piece of art. Can you imagine all of those colors just finding their way onto that canvas all by themselves? And ending up like that? Can you imagine someone like me trying to do something like that? It would look different. I mean, paint by numbers is as far as I'd be able to go. And then I'm not even sure I always stay within the boundaries of the numbers. But a great accomplished artist can create wonderful art. And so it is with God, Paul's saying. You can look around creation and you have to logically deduce that there has to be a creator. You look at the wonderful art, my God, how great thou art. The classic hymn reminds us. Then sings my soul, I see you moving through your creation. We have no excuse, Paul says. We should all know that there's a God, and there's so that if there's a God of creation, there's a God who's bigger than us, who has more power than us. And now Paul's getting into the heart of what he wants to say in Romans 1. I want to kind of do an overview of Romans 1, 2, and 3 with you today. And this is going to be a little different. Normally when I preach, I aim for the heart. Today we're shooting for the head because it's Romans. Romans is definitely for your head. It'll trickle down to your heart, I hope. And I'm sure that's what Paul had in mind too. But he wants to make sure in your head you understand who God is, who you are, and how you relate to one another. And what the faithful way is of looking at that relationship with God. He starts by saying, this is good news. This is the gospel. He says the way we're going to get right with God is by faith, by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. He goes on to say, everybody should know, first of all, that there's a God just by looking at a creation. Creation doesn't create itself. It demands logically a creator. That makes sense. But now let's look at this creation that we are a part of. Let's look at this world. And Paul says, not only here's how we get right in God's sight, but the other side of that same coin is what's wrong? If we need to be made right, that assumes that there must be something wrong. So what's wrong with us in this world? And that's where Paul gets kind of personal. Let's read the words that are up on the screen together. Yes, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship him as God or even give him thanks. As a result, their minds became dark and confused. And then let's look at this next screen and read this together as well. So God abandoned them to do whatever shameful things their hearts desired. Burned with lust, greed, hate, envy, murder, quarreling, deception, malicious behavior, and gossip. Feeling a little convicted yet? That's harsh. I mean, I'll tell you what this is. This is tough love. But in a way, it's kind of refreshing. Because you get to Romans and you think, okay, well, at least he's telling the truth. At least there's an honesty. There's just a raw honesty to what Paul is writing here in Romans 1. As we do this overview for Romans 1, 2, and 3, I want to ask you, where do you sit? Are you more of a Romans 1 person these days, a Romans 2 person, or a Romans 3? A Romans 1 person is somebody who's caught in this sort of maze of immorality, who's caught in a sinful kind of repetitious behavior, and you haven't been able to break free from it, and you keep trying to will yourself to do it, and that's the problem with being a part of this world. We are by nature sinful and unclean ever since the Garden of Eden, and it's not just Adam and Eve that we get to blame for it, because their original sin is our original sin. That's our place in the garden. We're Adam and Eve. We do the same things they did all the time. That's our condition as human beings. We can't stop sinning. This is where it gets real personal and real practical, and you start to realize, yeah, there are points in my life pretty much every day where I have some choices to make. I could choose good or I could choose evil. I could choose the way of God, and my conscience tells me I know the way of God, or I could choose the way of the devil. I could choose good or evil, right or wrong. Friday night, I went to a track meet. I'm the PA announcer for the Waukee track meets. And this year they've had a lot of track meets. Usually it means like two times a year. But this year it's been more than two. And it's fun, but it's a long night, you know. And the reason I'm the PA announcer is I volunteered for it because there's nothing worse than just sitting there the whole time, you know. So now at least I get to do something. So I'm up in the booth and I'm doing the PA for this district meet. It's kind of a big meet, you know. You qualify for state at this meet. And so it's a big deal for a lot of these athletes that have been working so hard to their goal all season. Some of them have the goal of making state. So I'm trying to be very precise, and I'm trying to be accurate, and that's hard for me. I get to about the halfway point of the meet, I get to that point, and they put before me a submarine sandwich. I forgot to tell you the beginning of the story. Since Tuesday, I've been on a very strict diet. This is the 434th diet that I've been on. in the last 10 years. For 10 years, I don't go up a whole lot, I don't go down a whole lot, but for 10 years I've been trying to lose 10 pounds. I mean, at least 10 years, and at least 10 pounds, sometimes 12. But for 10 years I've been trying to lose, and see, you're all looking at me, I'm just gonna button up and kind of, posture makes you lose 10 pounds, so there we go. But if I could lose 10, man, I'd be happy. I'd be a happy camper. I'm happy anyway, but if I could lose 10, I'd be really happy about that. So Tuesday comes, and I find that's it, man. I get on the scale, I look at it, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm so sick of this. I'm going to lose these 10 pounds, and I'm just going to do it by the Mike Householder will yourself to lose 10 pounds diet. I'm going to force myself to do it. I'm stronger than the temptation to eat all this food. I'm going to choose right over wrong, good over evil, God's way over the devil's way. My body's a temple, the Bible says. I'm going to do it because I'm stronger than this food. I'm going to will myself not to eat it. I'm doing good Tuesday. I'm doing good Wednesday. I'm doing good Thursday. Friday morning, I get up. I have total. I bypass the Cocoa Puffs and the Frosted Flakes. I have the total. I have a very healthy lunch, no snacks in between. I get to the track meet, and they put this sub in front of me. I know Jared lost like 8,000 pounds eating subs, but not these kinds of subs. And these subs are loaded. I mean, these subs have all the good stuff on them, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, see, here's what we do. This is how fallen we are as human beings. Start to justify. I'm not telling anybody this. It's just processing in my head. I'm thinking, I'm burning some calories up here. I'm very busy sitting in this chair, talking. That burns calories, right? So I can eat the sub. I've been so good. I'm just gonna go ahead and swallow that. So I nibble on that between the breaks and the action, and I take that down quick, and then they threw some chips in front of me. I'm like, well, you know, you gotta balance it out. You need a balanced diet, so I'll have some chips. And then Fran comes up and throws me a cookie. I'm like, well, thanks, Fran. I don't want to break your heart or hurt your feelings, so I'll eat your cookie. And then there's all these pops, and they're not necessarily diet pops, and I'm drinking all these pops because I'm, you know, got to keep your voice moist as you're going through this thing. And I'm trying to do all this stuff, and I'm justifying. That's not the half of it. I get home, and my wife didn't know that I'd eaten all this food. And she looked at me, and she said, with the kindest wife voice in the world, you must be starving. It's like 10 o'clock. You haven't had anything to eat since lunch. I'm like, well, here's the moment, folks. Good or evil? Right or wrong? Sally makes this particular sandwich for me. I just call it the Sally Special. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just my favorite. And she says, do you want me to make you one of those? Yes, I do. And then she asked me the follow-up question. Do you want one or two? If you're gonna sin, sin boldly, right? So that's what Luther said. Let's go with two. Do you want anything with it? Whatever you got, just go ahead and throw it on there. So I eat this second dinner. It gets worse. My daughter is downstairs with her friends having a sleepover. In about a half hour after I finish this, it's, you know, about 11 o'clock now, she calls up, hey, can we have some frozen pizza? Sure, no problem. Who doesn't like frozen pizza? It's like eating crackers, very light. And so she throws it in. And she looks at me, she says, well, they're not going to eat it all. Do you want a piece? Define want. I mean, what do you mean by want? Good or evil, right or wrong? Yes, I do. I do want a piece. Give me that pizza. So I eat the piece of pizza. Then I'm watching ESPN with Danny when he finally comes home, and we're kind of going through his day and kind of catching up, and he's eating the pizza, and he's got a piece left over, and he looks at me, he's like, Dad, I can't finish this. I had like 8 pieces. You want this one? Well, thank you, son. As a matter of fact, I do. So if you're keeping score, that's 2 pieces of pizza plus 2 dinners plus everything in between from about 5 o'clock to about midnight. Now, that is not the Mike Householder willpower diet that I meant to follow. We're just talking about food here. We're just talking about diets, which I don't mean to minimize. It's important. Your health is important. Your body's a temple. Yes, yes, yes. But what about the stuff that isn't just about hurting you? What about the decisions we get confronted with on almost a daily basis, right or wrong? Am I going to take this opportunity to tear that person down because they did something that kind of offended me? Or it just makes me feel better when I do? Or am I going to speak kindly and put the best possible construction on the actions of this person, even though I have a hard time loving this person all the time? Right or wrong? Which way are you going to go? Or it gets much more profoundly serious. You get tempted to break the covenant of your marriage, the vows that you made, the promises you made to each other to be faithful. And you try to justify it. You say, I know, God, you've got these boundaries, and I try to follow them, but, you know, my emotional needs aren't being met in my marriage, so it's okay, right? So it's okay. Now, I'm just going to step out of bounds for a while here because it just seems like that would be the right thing to do right now. Or at least I'll tell myself that. Or you step out of bounds and you cheat on a test, or you cheat on your taxes, or you make a deal at work that you know isn't honest. But if you get away with it, you'll make a little more money. Or you'll look a little better to the company. And that might help you along the way. Every day, almost every day, almost every single one of us is confronted with these moral dilemmas. And you could even say, you know, most of the time I do pretty well. Sure, I eat an extra piece of pizza once in a while, or I gossip a little bit, or I do some things I shouldn't do, but you know. And that's where we can get a little too comfortable, where Romans 1 won't let us. Paul is in attack mode here, folks, but it's a love. It's a tough love. And he starts by talking about sexual sin. And, you know, you can hear that and say, oh, I got issues, but sexual sin's not my issue, so bring it on. In fact, let's focus on that. Then I'll feel falsely comfortable that I stand right before God in his sight because I don't have sexual sin in my life. Not like Paul's talking about here. I'm not degrading my body like that. That's not me. I'm okay. That's them. And I'd rather talk about them than me. But just a few verses later, and on the same list, Paul says it's greed and hate and envy, not just sexual sin, greed. Anybody in love with your money? You have a temptation to think that your money is going to reward you and is going to have godlike qualities, which means the more you get, the happier you'll be, and the less you have, the unhappier you'll be. And I'm not naive. I understand that it's good to want to make a comfortable living, and I also want to make sure you understand there's nothing evil, biblically speaking, with having a lot of money. God has blessed you with that, and with that blessing comes all sorts of responsibility to be faithful with it, because it's not ours. We just take care of it while we're here. We can't take it with us when we go. But it's money. It's money, and money's important, but money's lousy, God. And so Paul puts greed on the list. Is money the most important thing in your life? That's sin. Is hatred an issue for you? When I say hate, do you have two or three names that come right to mind? You know, I got some people I hate. Here they are in my head right now. Bing, bing, bing. It's sin. God says you can't do that. You got to learn to let that go. Why? Why so intense, God? Why not just cut us some slack? I give you my law for a blessing. I want you to have a new life. I want you to be set free. In a movie called Les Miserables. In one of the opening scenes, Jean Valjean, a thief, shows up at the home of a bishop and his assistant. And he's needing to steal some things, and he basically knocks on the door to tell him, I'm going to take some of your stuff. And you're going to have to let me do it because I'm a thief and I'm supposed to scare you. Well, the bishop's assistant is scared to death. She's freaking out. But the bishop is calm. He's got faith. And he sees the potential for something else in this relationship. He sees the potential for a new life. And that's what God sees in you, even though he knows you step outside of those boundaries. He wants to put you back in those boundaries so that you can live a new life, so that you can be blessed. Take a look. We're the thief in this story.
Who can that be?
Do you have any food you can spare for me?
Come in.
Look, I'm a convict. My name is Jean Valjean. I've served 19 years hard labor. They let me out 4 days ago. I'm on parole. I have to go all the way to Dijon to report by Monday, or they'll send me back to prison. So here's my passport. I can't read, but I know what it says. He's very dangerous.
Monsieur, you're welcome to eat with us as my guest.
I'm a convict. You saw my passport.
I know who you are.
You're gonna let me inside your house.
What crime did you commit?
Maybe I killed someone. How do you know I'm not going to murder you?
How do you know I'm not going to murder you?
What's that? A joke?
I suppose we'll have to trust each other.
I didn't kill anyone. I'm a thief. I stole food. I stole, but I paid for it. 19 years in chains. So they let me out and they give me a yellow passport. What can I do with a yellow passport? I have to go to my parole officer in Dijon, and then what? Starve to death? 19 years, and now the real punishment begins.
Men can be unjust.
Men, not God. All right, whoever you are, thank you. A meal and a bed to sleep in. A real bed. And in the morning, I'll be a new man.
A new man, a new woman. That's why God invites us into this story. You know, he could have just said, all right, if that's the way you want to go, world, in my sovereignty, I give you the freedom to choose your own path. You can choose my path or you can choose your own. You choose your own over and over again. I'll let you go. You go ahead. You're on your own. But he invites us back into the story. He invites us back in. He invites the Romans 1 people, the folks who really struggle with immorality, and that's all of us. We're all there. There are some who don't think they are. They even look at the list. You can look at the list now. Some of you are tempted to say, I'm good. No, go back to the list. I'm good on that list. That's not a problem for me. I'm passing all of those tests. But then we turn the page to chapter 2, and maybe this is where you are. You're a Romans 2 person, where you take the easy road to judge other people, where you're good at pointing the finger. Let's read this verse together. You may think you can condemn such people, but you're just as bad, for you judge others. You who judge others do these very same things. I brought the easy button along.
That was easy.
It's the easy road. It's the easy road to pretend that you have the authority to judge other people. Oh, hi, Mike.
In the name of all things holy and just, like me, what are you doing?
Hear ye, how you doing there, Mike Horseman? I'm just, you know, preaching my sermon on Romans.
Really?
Yeah, really.
This is your message. This setting is your message where you're putting the shades down so nobody can see what you're talking about.
That's actually...
Where's your robe? Where's your robe?
I don't have my robe.
Oh, and the 80s called. They went the sport look back. Sport coat look back. Your pants don't even match your shirt.
Yeah, I know. That's probably a problem.
And you're given a message.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Kind of critical.
Can you turn around a second? I got to make a call.
You want me to turn around?
I do.
Well, why do you want me to turn around?
I just need you to turn around so I can talk about you behind your back.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah, so I'm here at Church of Hope, and there's a Reverend Mike Householder, or excuse me, Pastor Mike. He's very contemporary looking now. He's trying to deliver a message. I'm not sure. We don't have the pants that match the coat, and he's up here with no pulpit and nothing to pound on. But all right, well, I'll try that too. Okay, bye. Okay, you can turn around now.
Oh, yeah.
You continue on. I'm sure you have a beautiful gift to proclaim God's word, and you're a fabulous pastor, so I'm sure you're going to do the right thing.
Oh, gee, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
There, Judge. Really appreciate that. That's the judge, everybody. Good job. That's the easy road. Turn around. I'd rather talk behind your back. And then when they aren't in the room, we have all sorts of things to say about it. And then when they come back in the room, we have something else to say. There's a whole different song we start singing. That's a problem. It's the easy road the world says to take, and a lot of us take it because it's comfortable. It makes us feel better about ourselves for a little while, but it doesn't do anything to enhance our relationships with other people. That's why God gives us the law, to bless you in your relationships with other people, to give you this new life, to put you back on this track, to change you from a thief to a person who's free and isn't going back to that lifestyle, to change you from a gossiper to somebody who isn't going to do that anymore, to change you from somebody who's broken the covenant of your marriage to somebody who isn't going to do that anymore. Changing us, that's what God is looking for. And that's what Paul is laying out here in Romans 1. He's saying, if you think you can get right with God because you're moral enough, take a look at this list and see if you're still good enough to jump that bar. And if you think you are, go to Romans 2 and you'll realize that nobody's good enough, especially those who are judging the people who they think they're better than. Or they think that they're going to be right with God because they follow God's law. They misunderstand God's law. Paul knows. He was the biggest advocate and the most legalistic person on the face of the earth for following God's law. He knew it incredibly well. And he told everybody, this is how you get right with God. You follow God's law. But then he was set free. He was transformed. He was converted. And he heard the good news of Jesus Christ. He realized the truth, that the law convicted him just like it did everybody else, that he'd never stand right in God's sight because he was a moral person. None of us is good enough, not one, the Bible says, over and over again, to stand before a holy God. But still, we want to take the easy road. We want to cut other people down. Let me make this real kind of, you know, direct to you on this part. In the last few days of your life, what's come out of your mouth more, praise or criticism? I'm not talking about constructive criticism, which there's a place for. It's not as big a place as a lot of people think. But what's come out of your mouth more, praise or criticism? The Bible clearly says over and over, what we're to do as followers of the way of Jesus Christ is to build each other up, to praise one another, to encourage one another, to lift each other up. The rest of the world tears each other down, divides each other, gossips about each other, gets real comfortable about talking about people in a critical way when they aren't in the room, but then when they come back, two-faces them and says something else. Which one better describes you? And here's the whole thing. God wants you to get out of that predicament. He wants you to change so that you can be free, because there's no freedom in that. There's no life in that. What comes out of your mouth more fluently? The healthiest people on the face of the earth praise. They're the ones who always speak. You know these people. They never say an unkind word about anybody. And you admire them. They've got something. Well, they've got God's Spirit in them. They've had this transformation. Then there are the people who are always criticizing. I remember several years ago somebody joined this church and he said to me, I have the spiritual gift of criticism. It's like, that's not a spiritual gift. It's not in the Bible. That's sinful. It's destructive to the body. That's not going to help. It's so easy in this fallen, messed up, imperfect world. It's easy. Anybody can press that easy button. Anybody can look at anything they want and find something that isn't perfect. And if you're the one who takes pride in always pointing that out, well, good for you. God's not impressed at all. He wants to teach you to be a praiser of good things. to be a builder up of people, somebody who lifts people up, somebody who encourages people. That's what followers of the way are called to be. What comes out of your mouth more fluently, praise or criticism? Where is it that God's leading you? Is God's spirit all the way in you, and does it allow you to move in this way? Paul's really hitting us here. Romans 1, people are lost in a world of immorality, and that's going to keep us wrong in God's sight. Romans 2, people are lost in judgmentalism, and they're stuck in their criticisms and gossiping about people behind each other's backs. As Paul will write in Romans 7, the good stuff I want to do, I don't do, and the evil stuff I don't want to do, I end up doing. What's wrong with me, Paul wonders, and who will rescue me from this condition? Thanks be to God, it's Jesus Christ. Romans 3. All people, whether Jews or Gentiles, are under the power of sin, and it's very powerful. So powerful, we can't escape it. The law applies. Its purpose is to keep people from having excuses and to show that the entire world is guilty before God. The first use of the law is to create order in our relationships and to bless us. The more we follow God's law, the better it's going to be for us. The less you learn to gossip about other people, the better your friendships are going to be, because people end up hearing about it, and then they don't like you. The more you tell the truth, the better your relationships are going to be, because people don't like liars. So they don't like hanging around with you because you're always telling them lies. The more you encourage people and lift each other up, the more people are going to want to be around you. It's going to be better for you. It's going to be better for your relationships. The first purpose, the first use of the law is to bless you and to bless me in our relationships with other people, in our relationship with God. The second purpose, the second use of the law, is to tell us the truth that we need a Savior, that we need to be forgiven, that because of this sin, and sometimes the sin is judgmentalism, we're in trouble on judgment. We do not stand righteous before a holy God. Who will rescue me from this condition? Are you sitting most of your spiritual life in Romans 1, trying to pretend that you can moralize your way to heaven? Are you spending most of your Christian life in Romans 2, criticizing the rest of the body of Christ, tearing them down, always pointing out what's wrong with other Christians, other people? Or are you a Romans 3 Christian, living in grace, living in God's amazing grace, His powerful, life-changing grace? Oh, and when you get a word of grace, when you experience grace from another human being, it's so wonderful. You know what kind of broke my heart? Normally when I'm writing a sermon, I'll start on Sunday or Tuesday. I take Mondays off. And I'll lay it all out, and then I'll start watching you. And normally, watching me, and watching the world around me, and watching the news, and paying attention to what's going on. And the sermon will start to take shape in different sorts of ways. Watching movies, watching things, reading books, taking a perspective on what's going on. And that's the way usually the sermons bubble up. This week, knowing I was going to be preaching on Romans 1, 2, and 3 and ending up with God's grace, I'm looking all over for grace. I'm looking for grace. I'm looking for grace. You know what broke my heart? Is how hard it is to find. Because we live in a world where you earn it or you deserve it. And if you haven't earned it or deserve it, you rarely get it. Not a whole lot of examples of amazing grace out there. I'm not saying they aren't there. They're there. It hit me Friday. I'm announcing this track meet. We're toward the end of the meet, and it's time for the medley relay. And normally, when I'm announcing it, I look out at the lanes, and I call out the lane assignments. In lane one, it's Oskaloosa, and here are the four people running the relay for Oskaloosa. Lane two, it's Des Moines East, and here are the four people running the relay for East. And all the way down to lane eight. So I'm reading off the names of the girls' medley relay. Lane one, I read the girls' names. Lane two, I read the girls' names, all the way to lane eight. I get to lane eight, and Craig, this kind, great, wonderful volunteer at Waukee, who was kind of sitting by me off and on the whole meet and volunteering, doing other things, he walks over to me, He gently puts his hands on my shoulders as I get to lane 8, announcing the girls' medley relay. And he says, "Mike, these are the boys." I don't know why. I hadn't looked up once the whole time. I had just read 32 girls' names and their lane assignments for the girls' medley relay, and I look down on the track, and half the boys are waving at the press box, along with the officials, like, "No!" And some of the guys are standing down there like, "Clearly we are not girls, okay? You wear one of these speed suits, it becomes very obvious." Which is a whole nother sermon for another day. "Clearly, we are the boys." Oh, just telling you this story now, I can feel the heat coming up into my face. When it happened on Friday, and Craig told me this in a very gentle, kind way, I just went beet red. I could feel it. I just went beet red. I just, Think of all the mistakes you could make as a PA announcer. That would be up in the top 5. I read all 32 of their names. Craig sits down. He can tell, I'm sure, that this is just killing me. And he finally says, "Hey, Mike, you know, you're just ahead of your time. The girls are coming up. Now you don't have to announce it." "Thanks. I appreciate that. That's a kind word." Another minute later, he could tell, still bugging me, said, "Hey, nobody expects perfection up here. You're fine." Do you notice he didn't say, "You didn't make a mistake. You know, you're good. It's because you're good. That's why, you know, we still love you." No, he's just all grace. "Hey, nobody expects perfect. You're fine. You're fine. Okay, if you don't hear anything else I say today, hear this. Everything you've ever done wrong, all of it, all the mistakes, all the messes you've made, all the extra pieces of pizza you've eaten, all the much more serious things you've done to hurt other people, sometimes to destroy relationships, to break people apart, to crush their hearts, to stomp on them on your way to the top. All that stuff. All of it. I don't want you thinking about the people around you and the stuff they've done. I want you and God to do some business right now. All the stuff that you have done that is outside the boundaries of God's will, that has hurt God, that has hurt other people, and that has hurt you, or any of the above. All of it. All of it. All of it. God offers you forgiveness for all of it. All of it. That's grace. Please notice God didn't say, "You deserve it, that's why I'm giving it to you. It's because you're such a good person, that's why I'm going to forgive you. It's because you're asking, that's why I'm giving it to you. It's because you have such a wonderful, strong, spiritual resume, that's why I'm giving it to you." Doesn't say that in the Bible. He says, "I'm just giving it to you because I'm God. Because I choose to give it to you. Because I choose to offer you this gift." Romans 3, living in grace. Folks, if you aren't sitting here in your life, this is where you need to learn to sit. Living in grace. You say, "Yeah, but what about morality? And what about correcting the things that are wrong? That's my passion. I want people to be more moral. I get really mad when they're not." That's not the goal of Christianity. The goal of Christianity is to teach you to live in God's grace. You say, "Yeah, it's cheap. That cheap grace stuff, it just drives me crazy." Oh, we're all forgiven. So why don't we just go out and do whatever we want then? We'll have the best of both worlds. Go out and do whatever I want, and God will forgive me, so who cares, right? You missed it again. Why would you go out and do what God doesn't want? Why would you go out and break God's law? Haven't you already seen what that's done for you? And what that's done for people around you? And what that's done for your relationship with God? If you've been set free from prison, why would you go lock yourself back up? Grace has set you free. Sin is very powerful. The power of sin is amazing. We can't escape it. But grace is more powerful. God's mercy is wider than your sin. It's wider than my sin. Why would we want to go back? You see, grace not only sets us free and allows us to stand right in God's sight, but it is the power. It is the power to change us, to transform us, to make all things new. That new life that the bishop and the thief talked about at the end of that scene in Les Miserables, that scene right there, that new life, that's what God wants for you, the transformation. And it isn't going to come by you doing the spiritual willpower diet. I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to stop doing it. I'm going to stop doing it. I'm going to find the will inside of me to stop doing it. You probably won't. You probably won't. Not if you're going to sit on the Romans 1 or the Romans 2 bench. But if you hang out in Romans 3, but now God has shown us a way to be made right with him without keeping the requirements of the law by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. Now you've found the way to this light. The thief, Jean Valjean, wakes up in the middle of the night and he does what he does. He starts to steal the good silver, the most expensive stuff in the bishop's house. And he and the bishop have a confrontation. I showed this clip about 8 years ago, and I've still never found anything even close to as good at illustrating God's grace. Make no mistake about it, in this scene, you and I were the thief. The bishop represents God in every detail. Take a look.
Is anybody there? So we'll use wooden spoons. I don't want to hear anything more about it.
I'm sorry to disturb you.
You caught him.
But I had my eye on this man.
Oh, thank God. I'm very angry with you, Jean Valjean.
What happened to your eye, Monseigneur?
Didn't he tell you he was our guest last night?
Oh, yes. After we searched his knapsack and found all this silver, he claimed that you gave it to him.
Yes. Of course I gave him the silverware. But why didn't you take the candlesticks? That was very foolish. Madame Gillot, fetch the silver candlesticks. They're worth at least 2,000 francs. Why did you leave them? Hurry. Monsieur Valjean has to get going. He's lost a lot of time. Did you forget to take them?
Are you saying he told us the truth?
Of course. Thank you for bringing him back. I'm very relieved.
Release him.
You're really letting me go?
Didn't you understand the bishop?
Madame Gillot, offer these men some wine. They must be thirsty.
Thank you.
Don't forget. Don't ever forget. You've promised to become a new man.
Promise? Why are you doing this?
Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil. With this silver, I've bought your soul. I've ransomed you from fear and hatred. And now I give you back to God.
Only grace has the power to transform a life like that. Where are you sitting these days with God? Trying to get right with God through your morality? Trying to get right with God by condemning other religious people? Or knowing that you're right with God because of his grace? Because he sent his son Jesus to die as a sacrifice for your sin. My favorite part of that scene, which I've now seen over and over and over again, is when the bishop takes Valjean's hood and throws it off. As if God is saying, you cannot hide from me. I see you. I know exactly who you are. And I'm here to tell you that evil no longer has its hold on you. That you now are my brother. I've bought your soul by my grace. That's what Paul's saying here in Romans 1, 2, and 3. The way that you know that you know that you're going to stand right before a holy God is by putting your trust in a holy God who loves you so much that he'll forgive you for all of it. For all of it. Not just so it won't be held against you, but listen again in your mind to the conversation and what the bishop says to the reformed thief. You go and you live this new life now. You've been set free from your sin. Go and sin no more. It's the amazing power of God's grace, and it's for you. It's for you. Please don't miss it. Sit over there. Amen. Go in peace. Serve the Lord.